Welcome back to our listeners that might have listened to Dinesh on part one of this podcast. For those that are tuning in and haven't listened to part one, I thoroughly recommend you go back and do that before listening to part two, because it has got a natural flow into this episode. We left off at around the turn of the millennium and your work with the LDSA. We're going to pick up now on something that was personal to you, the work that you did following the earthquake in Gujarat. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there, the effects of the earthquake, and the work that you did to support the nation after that event?
Thank you, Steve. Yes, that was very dear to me. It was the earthquake, a magnitude 7.6, was very, very significant. It happened in my ancestral home where my parents came from and lived for almost 300 years. Our generations of families, we come from a place called Bhuj in Kutch, which is the northwest region of India. Gujarat is about the same size as the UK in regards to the population, as nice. Well as the area. It's 53 million people as it was at that time. And the area where Bhuj is prominently based on a number of fault lines and was an old rift valley, a bit like the rift valley in Kenya, you know, in Africa, which has been backfilled, if you like.
Nice.
With fill. But it's a moving rift valley. It's not on the tectonic plate, which is the Himalayas, but it's a moving rift valley. And historically, it has had earthquakes, but at the time that I was being brought up, my parents were with me, the biggest earthquakes were not even known. We knew about small earthquakes, but at the time I was not an earthquake engineer.
No.
But at the time I didn't know that we had such big earthquakes. As it happened, there was an earthquake that happened in 2001 that killed certain members of my family, and that brought home the fact that actually I needed to do something personal to get back to those people who actually suffered from the immediate effects of the damage to their homes. There were thousands of people who died in the earthquake, and the people who actually lost their homes were just rebuilding their homes with the fallen goods of the earthquake materials that they were there. It was the natural thing to do. If buildings were damaged and their concrete structures with soft column problems, where earthquake was shaken and it's burst the column, the reinforcement, the cover has gone off the concrete. You get soft column problems, you get pancaking problems, the floors just fall in onto the columns, which panic pancake, and that's how many
progressive failure.
Yeah. And many people died because none of these buildings were really designed. Even though India had the codes of practice to do it, it's just that actually other people, the house owners had more priority than designing for the earthquakes. So, you know, there was unfortunately not a lot of policing going on when you built your homes. You know, we don't have local authorities here who come around and actually look at your extension, for example. Have you built it properly? The foundation's fine. Is the roof waterproof, etc.? That policing doesn't exist. So none of the buildings were essentially designed for earthquake proof. It's now changed, but I got involved because I felt that I saw the fact that people were rebuilding with lessons that didn't bring in the good lessons of earthquake resistant homes. So just building as normal, if you like, rather than taking small steps. For example, if you rebuild a column, instead of having the important thing that the earthquake engineering, for example, required, is that actually there's enough links at smaller spaces, you know, 75 mil links holding the main bars in a column, as opposed to maybe 300 spaces, if you like. And what that does is binds the column with lots of like elastic bands, if you like, you know,
yeah.
So that if you do get some lateral shaking, the concrete cover doesn't come off, if you like. And a lot of the problems where the concrete cover came off, the reinforcement exposed, you know, and then Once the reinforcement exposed, any more further shaking that you've had just collapsed the whole column.
And is that applicable purely to the superstructure, or does it impact the foundation design as well?
It impacts the foundation design as well, and so the, a lot of that. So we put together, I worked with a few of the structural engineers I knew, the people I knew, Devraj and Kimjin, and they weren't necessarily Arab people, but they understood the way things were being built in our part of the country.
Yeah.
And I understood the sort of foundations that were being built in our part of the country. Okay. So we got together in this kind of climate of emergency, you know, where people were doing the wrong things, and we said, well, look, let's put together a guide, a bit like the LDSA guide,
sure,
but a blow-by-blow account of actually, if you've got stone buildings, that actually, how do you rebuild it safely, okay, when it's fallen, you know, down? How do you do that? How do you do mitigation, repairs of structurally damaged concrete or steel structures? Okay. So we chose three different types of materials and said, look, you know, here is some cartoon figures of how to rebuild it safely, provided these buildings are no more than about three stories. So, it's, you know, so there is a guide that we put together, which is a Gujarat repair guide for low-rise buildings. I went to some of our seismic experts within Arabs and said, look, have I said anything there that could jeopardize people's well-being, you know, or greater health hazard, if you like, because I'm giving guidance that might result in damage, if you like, damage, but as long as it didn't hurt anybody, you know. Earthquakes will damage properties, but as long as you design things safely so that it doesn't kill people, that's the main objective.
Okay. Sure.
So we put something together, and then the Gujarat State Disaster Management Authority, which was responsible for the repair of all the damaged structures, bridges, houses, etc., in Gujarat, the size of the UK, found out that we put this guide together that helped a group of people, which might have been about a million people. Said, well, why don't you come over and actually teach all our chief engineers in Gujarat what best practice is to rebuild things back? And they can then take that through as like resident engineers to these households and say, right, don't do this, but do this safely. And here's a little picture. People can read pictures.
Yes.
More than, you know, 1,000 words. So we put pictures together on how to do this. Okay. We also had Robin from Cambridge, because he was an expert on retrofitting damage of structures as well. His background was structures as well as architecture. So we got a collection of the right people.
Yeah.
And I also spent some time as part of the EFIT team looking at overall what lessons could be learned from damage of dams, bridges, infrastructure assets, if you like, as well as dwellings, if you like, you know, with Gopal Madhubishi, which is actually who was leading that team from Cambridge, you know, excellent chap. And he formed the team that was the EFIT team that actually we were part, I was part of, if you like.
Yeah.
So that was dear to my heart because, as I said, you know, it's an area of expertise that's outside my field, but I felt passionate enough to give something back. Yeah. If it saved one life, I'm happy. If it saved more, even better. But it's just like changing.
There's that group at the IC, Red R, I think.
Yes.
A charity. It sounds like the sort of project that they might get involved with.
I'm probably too old for Red R, but actually, I was at that time. but you're absolutely right. It's that sort of thing. But I think, you know, because we were trying to bring our technical knowledges into geotechnics and, you know, earthquake engineering all together with the blessing of experts. You know, we weren't experts, but we knew our stuff technically.
So it was around this time you started to become more internationally based, really. You moved out to Malaysia and worked on some infrastructure projects. Can you tell us a little bit more about the time and the influence that you had on the projects that would form an important part of the Commonwealth Games?
Yeah. I'd already started to work on quite, as you quite rightly say, quite a few projects, you know, and one of them was the Kuala Lumpur Light Rail Transit System, which is a 30-kilometer route, which is an elevate, a bit like Docklands Light Railway.
Sure.
Okay. Not underground, but actually a series of piers that come out in the street, if you like, and then you have you build a railway, you know. And what we did was design we were acting as the lead designer for Taylor Woodruff International, which had an enormous reputation for us at the time. It was one of the lead companies that did things very well, and had essentially the project managers, the project directors, the contractors were the best of the best that I worked with ever in those days. You know, they knew their stuff, and they'd already done the very first KLLRT. There's more of them now than it was at the time with Travis Morgan. And they embarked on phase two of the KRT project. And they wanted people this time to not work remotely, but to work in their offices side by side. So you were doing design of bridges, infrastructure, stations, all in-house with them. And geotechnics, of course. Okay. So we had a bunch of key people. I was one of the lead. I was the lead geotechnical engineer for this £500 million railway project. And the objective was that actually they needed to get this railway up and running for the Commonwealth Games, which is, I think, in 1998. And we had a very short window of about 3 years from start to finish to design a huge amount of embankments, huge amount of elevated and upgrade stations, a huge amount of cemented bridges. These are post-tension cemented bridges, which where you build a pier and you have a balanced cantilever ridge, if you like. So it segments the bridge come out as if my left and right hand is simultaneously coming out of my body, if you like. So my body is the pier. So for those people who don't know, these bridges were, you know, they are, you have some formwork and you build them out to the next pier, and without causing too much disturbance and to the traffic below you, and you automatically got your cemented bridge built. Not only were we designing those, we were designing box girder bridges. So suddenly, you know, I was a lead infrastructure geotechnical engineer trying to understand bridge design, centrifugal forces, breaking forces, and how these forces all went down through the piers down into the foundation. But in the absolute the worst ground conditions ever. Okay, and even now I claim that that was one of my biggest challenges, you know, in the sense that actually I was just kind of lifted out of London and dropped into the deep end in KL. We encountered very strong Kenny Hill formations, which is a quartzite material, very difficult piling project if you came across these materials. Then pinnacled limestones, you know, if you see these, if you ever go on holiday to Thailand, you see these limestone pinnacles coming out of the ocean. That's underground for us, okay? You know, one moment we'd be piling on top of a pinnacle and it's only 30 meters down. And then next moment, you're about 2 meters away from me at the moment, as we speak. I wouldn't find the rock head for another 100 meters. So you're down the side of a pinnacle.
Yeah.
How do you design foundations when you are coming across these things?
Yeah.
And then there were these, what was referred to as slime, where the silver from the pinnacle limestone was dug out about 150 years ago by Chinese labor, and they backfilled the lagoons with pumped slurry, which is now referred to as slime, which is basically an alluvial silt, you know, that they took out and then pumped back in again. So it's under consolidated,
Well, you asked the right question there. How do you design? Presumably, you would have a couple of approaches. One is based on a rock socket, if you hit the rock. The other is to have a sort of minimum pile length based on the worst case.
Yes, yeah.
Not hitting.
That's right. And it is rock socket based, if you like, okay? But you can preload the slime, and it could cause a huge amount of negative skin friction, which then suddenly the lock socket is long enough, okay. You like it, and you design for a negative skin friction of 30 meters or 100 meters. But you're right, but when you're thinking about it, this is all done under fluid, under polymer or under the bentonite. How do you know that you have got a solid rock at the bottom of the pile? How do you prove that? So we came with some inventive rules. For instance, when we clean the piles out, we were worried that there might be half on a socket and half down the side of the cliff.
I suppose that's going to happen at some point.
And how do I know that actually I got a pile that failed easily? So we were quite inventive. Sat down with Taylor and Woodrow and we said, look, we need to address these risks because, to me at the time, I'd learned about design, managing risk, if you like. And design was more about, design and construction was more about managing risk and how to deal with issues that might arise. So in this instance, we came across a way of actually saying, how do we know we've got a solid base? So we had a bucket, cleaning bucket, with a spike at the end.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's different. Yeah.
3 meter spike at the end.
Yeah.
We dropped it down. If it hit something soft, we know that it wasn't the rock.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have a flat rock everywhere. Now, then we had piles which are up to about 2.1 meters in diameter. So that helped us determine the risk of whether we're going to be half on rock and half not. If we were on half on rock, then we took the pile down until we got a rock socket of the whole area of the pile, but we are able to actually also allow for half a socket as a friction for the piles. That's just one example of many. We had to find solutions where we're going for cavities in limestone. If you have anybody who's gone to Malaysia, there's a famous cave, Batu Caves. It's huge, it's a huge cavern, okay? That's underground. Fortunately, we didn't hit one of those big ones, but we did find quite a few.
I hope this wasn't a lump sum contract.
Well, it was actually. Our fees were a bit lump sum. But how do you deal with that? So we found inventive ways of actually saying, right, okay, if we have a pile, before we build a pile, in these pinnacled limestone, we've got to have a borehole at every single pile location. That borehole has to show to a certain depth what the thickness of that rock was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it'd be a rotary type of borehole as opposed to.
Yeah. Because you can't prejudge when the pinnacles of limestone are happening, and the only way that the contractor could actually price and put the right gear on site is if they know what they're expecting, So we said, look, if you come across a cavity, by putting the borehole in, we'll know whether there's a cavity. Yeah. Mm. And if we have a cavity, we either it's either very thick and we have to do something totally different, build the pile well above the cavity so that it never punches through, rely on the rock socket above it. And have a certain distance above it. So we set some rules about what that was to avoid collapsing the cavity, or we drilled through it. So there were times when we said, right, okay, we'll have to have a pile, which is say 1.8 meters in diameter, stopping a few meters above the cavity, but we haven't got the capacities we need. So how do we get the capacity we need? So we put sleeves in the piles, and did micro pile, like the Fondini piles, 200 mil, 250 mil, diameter piles, maximum 300 mil diameter piles. So if the piles are large enough, we put three sleeves in there and go through the cavity sleeve the cavity with the CHSAC sections, if you like, and grout the pipe, and then transfer the load that we, the extra load, the additional load we need, in below the cavity, so to speak, you know. Yeah. So we're using the shaft friction of a big socketed pile, a bit of end bearing, and then some mini piles that actually allowed you to enhance that capacity, to give you the capacity that we're looking for in total.
Yeah, so like a base grouted pile.
Exactly, but with a pipe, yeah, you know, going down to solid ground again, just to bridge that cavity. Because you couldn't go along and fill the whole cavity, because sometimes when we try to do that, we just ended up with huge volumes of concrete that disappeared somewhere, you know?
Yes.
So there were little techniques like that we were dealing with. And another good one was actually where we had lots of approach embankments. We were building embankments, you know, we were designing embankments and elevator stations and bridges, as I said, you know, civils were, it was all of us, you know, there doing it. The key members were on site in the working with Taylor Woodrow, and I remember the first day I sort of landed, Taylor Woodrow said, look Dinesh, I don't want any piles on any of my embankments. And what he was trying to say, I had no idea what he was trying to say. It was great. Graham Quinion, one of the best project managers that I knew, he ran the whole show at Taylor Woodrow on this project. Is now retired, as I believe. And we sat down and said, look, you know, what's your objectives? What are you trying to do, you know? Said, look, you know, there are people there out there playing piled embankments. I can't afford to do piled embankments. I've got a deadline 3 years from now. Can't do it. What kind of, you know?
So yeah.
Don't come out.
It's an honor piling rings around.
Pile everything, okay, right? It's not the answer, Dinesh. I want you to be inventive. I want you to be giving me excellence. That's why you're here, okay? And that taught me some very, very valuable lessons in how I approach clients, okay? And try and understand from their perspective what the needs are from us, rather than impose designs to them, if you like, you know. And I thought, I know what the solution is. I sat down, looked at the program for when they were building these approach embankments up to these bridges on these very soft slime materials. The strength of these materials are like CU's less than 20. 15 is maximum, SPTs of 1 and 2s, okay, over 40 meters in some places.
Yeah, and what with the natural sort of angle of...
Oh, it flows, is like, you know, it just flows. It's basically a sort of a sandy silt.
Yeah.
It just flows, like, you know, you wet it and it just flows, yeah. You know? Where was I? Yes, the embankments. So we were building up to about 4 meters of embankments on these things. Okay, yeah. And I looked at the program and said, look, you know, you could use stone columns, you can use sand drains, you can use piles. Piles were out. Sand drains probably were okay. Prefabricated sand drains could be used. You know, they were quite inexpensive in those days, you know, to speed up consolidation, etc. Piling was definitely out. Stone columns were definitely out, because can you imagine this material is like tuff base and you're trying to put stone columns in it. All you've done is displaced the tuff base and you ended up with a column, you know, or as wide as the embankment of stone, okay, right? But that was the technique that was being used there. They were using a load, you know, elsewhere, other people were using it. Anyway, I said...
Lime stabilization? Is that?
No, it was too deep, and actually you wouldn't get the mixing going on that deep. You know? You could do it on shallower depths of 10 meters or something, not those depths. So I said to them, look, what we'll do is this material is basically a heavy, a sandy silt. So I worked out that if we pre-consolidated the embankments with some sand drains as well to speed up the consolidation, we could actually preload the embankment to higher than the final height of the embankment. and take out the primary settlement and a large portion of the secondary settlement of the embankment within the timescale of 6 months. Not only that, if we did the preloading beyond the embankment, so that the approach embankments, which were always piled, if you like, you know, you have approach embankments go in. If we did that, then you wouldn't have to design the piles for large lateral loads caused by building an embankment if had you not done any preloading, if you like, you know. Because generally in soft clays, you build an embankment, the piles have gone in first, and you get high horizontal forces have been attracted to it. But because the preload consolidated the ground, it improved the strength of the ground. Therefore, the horizontal forces were significantly less. Therefore, the size of piles was significantly less. Therefore, the amount of reinforcement you put into the pile heads was significantly less. Okay? And so the ground had been improved so that actually, as far as you know, any surcharge pressures you put on, is like the piles are saying, well, I've seen this, it doesn't matter anymore, because everything is stiffened around the piles, if you like, that go to the approach embankments. So that was the clever solution. That saved something like £10 million on the project.
Yeah. But you must have been still a bit wary whether that consolidation was going to happen, because presumably you were monitoring it through that 6 month period.
Yeah.
At what point did you relax?
Well, the observation method wasn't even mentioned, because there was no such thing as the OM method back in those days. Okay. Well, there was kind of the PEC stuff, but Duncan hadn't written too much about this kind of thing. So we were using by default an OM method, if you like. Okay? Yeah. And it was sustainable because we weren't putting piles into the sacred piles. Okay? Yeah. But when Taylor Woodrow actually looked at that, initially they thought I was bonkers, and then they said, oh, there's an attractiveness there. And I said, look, the first thing I want you to do is do some trials, you know, of sand drains and embankments, and I'd like to see these trials with instrumentation, heavily instrumented, see that it's working. If it works, then we will put this in your program, because I can see you've got about 9 months before you even get to a state where you're going to pile in your program. Okay. That 9 months, and I'm predicting 6 months consolidation, I've still got a float of another 3 months ahead of me. Okay. Yeah. So get in there now, even though I haven't done the design, get in there now, preload it. Okay. Which is what they did. Okay.
Yeah.
And then we monitored it. We monitored to monitor the size, you know, we had some berm areas as well as embankment to try and keep settlements low. We had plates that were at the bottom of the embankment and at the top, so we could measure consolidation, if you like, you know, we had some extensometers. So we knew that we were monitoring on a regular basis, and if we felt that actually we hadn't taken out all the pre-consolidation, we had a plan B, if you like. What do you do? But one of them was the float that I mentioned, which is 3 months, you know, between 6 and 9 months. And the other one was actually that, okay, we may have to pile parts of that embankment, you know. Okay? But it went down very well. And I found out later, for, you know, the stuff that we talked about, like, you know, do we know whether piles are in the right place or not, you know, or rock socketed piles, how we minimize the depth of rock sockets, how we address the risks of settlement on embankments, etc., how do we avoid putting unnecessary foundations in the ground, all down went well and was resulted in them delivering the project for the Commonwealth Games in a timely manner, without them incurring huge amounts of liquidity damages. So from a cost perspective and from a programs perspective, they had a really good deal from us, if you like.
Yeah. Well, I think that shows the benefit of having a clear deadline. You've come up with very innovative solutions there. Something perhaps to contrast with where we are, not talking about an individual business or anything, but HS2, you know, the cost just seems to have escalated, maybe a lack of flexibility in design and the way the whole thing's been procured. I could rant on about that for a while, but I think it does show, if if there's a will to be innovative, in geotechnics, the savings are huge. And the next project I want to talk to you about is Bishopsgate, which it was quite a radical approach. Sorry, I can't remember which number Bishopsgate.
6 to 8 Bishopsgate.
Yeah, very tall structure.
52 stories.
52 stories. And you would usually expect to see some huge piles and lots of them as for in a building like that. But you thought about that project quite differently.
So we're now back in Britain again.
Yes. Yeah,
from England to Britain.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it's all my life I've actually spent in geotechnics, doing exciting stuff that I enjoy doing, but actually building up a case studies, okay? Where there's case studies of basements, retaining walls, how they behave, you know, how I can use empiricism to have an understanding of how things deflect, if you like, and then use that to improve our tools, through Wallop, whatever it is, okay? Or collaboration. I've done that in the process. So I was building up a data bank of basements, you know, not just simple C-compile walls, but how does ground anchored walls behave? How does cantilever walls behave? How does C-compile walls behave? How does diaphragm walls behave? How does contig walls behave? How does king post walls behave? So over 20 years, I'd have built up measured information of these things for foundations, for basements, which are top down and bottom up.
Okay. Did that feed into the C5 data?
No, it didn't. It didn't get round to being fed into that. And it's something that I've been in my bonnet. Before I officially retire from many years from now, I need to publish it. Okay. Yeah. To benefit the community of geotechnical engineers. So that's come from the basement experience, and it's also come from the tall towers experience. And we've been monitoring tall towers, the settlement of tall towers, okay, and on different foundations, rafts, power rafts, piles, etc. So that's another area that I've got my people and be in my bonnet to actually publish. But coming back to the tower that you're talking about, the information I gathered from led to me doing something quite different and novel in 6 to 8 Bishopsgate. By then, I'd under my belt 5 towers. I'd done Heron Tower as the first one. I'd done the Pinnacle, which became a WSP job, but we put all the foundations into the ground when it was called the Pinnacle. I think it's called 100 Bishopsgate. I did Leadenhall Tower, the cheese grater, the Scalpel, if you like.
They've all got great names.
51 Lime Street, I think it's called, you know. So I've already done 4 towers. I learned a lot from monitoring, measuring. Okay. And I thought I'd do something completely different in 6 to 8 Bishopsgate. That had a 17 meter deep basement. I wanted to prop it with a single prop. So I got Blue Sky to make it faster construction. I wanted to build it as a raft with no piles to support a 52-story structure. Didn't quite got there because I still needed 22 piles in the heaviest core area where I got 1,000 meganewtons of load coming down with the core walls. So I made it into a 7-reducing pile raft in that area. But it's the first time that a building, a tower, a city tower has been built with only 22 piles.
Yeah.
Okay. Everything else is a raft, effectively. And that's my tallest project where I've actually tried to give value engineering excellence in design. And we saved something like £4 to £5 million in piling costs there.
It's true. My initial thoughts on that was, it must be sat on some very dense sand, but that wasn't the case, was it? It was actually onto the clay.
Oh, no, that one was actually, we took 22 piles down to the Thanet sand.
Oh, it was onto the Thanet,
On that one there.
Massive bearing capacity on that.
That's right. Yeah. But everything else elsewhere was actually, it's very much an understanding of the balancing act that you do with the weight of the building versus the depth of the excavation and the heave that you're getting, if you like, and what sort of water pressures are developing and how you design the foundation, et cetera. You know, from me, I've got a sustainability is the heart of all our projects in my company, at least, if you like. You know, even if the contract clients don't want it, we will give it to them free, and we will try and encourage them to take the advice that we're doing, you know, and reducing carbon, embedded carbon, you know, operational carbon, you know, it's real dear to everybody's heart in our profession. Doesn't matter whether you're a structural engineer, geotechnical engineer, infrastructure, civil person, it's very dear to us. And so whenever I do something like this, I'm saying, I don't want any piles. What can I do to avoid any piles? Okay? Because to me, I'm also looking at not just embedded and operation, I'm looking at the whole cycle. Okay, I have been or brought up in an era where London is so dense that there's 3 years of foundations, the whole sites have been blighted, and we're still piling. Not only are we still piling them, we're actually creating huge amounts of carbon by coring out all foundations just to go deeper. It just doesn't make any sense. And it's not helped by the fact that actually sometimes people think, and even today, sometimes think that actually smaller diameter piles are less carbon intensive than slightly bigger piles. And we'll have a forest of these things. But when you look at it from a whole cycle perspective, actually, you know, having smaller diameter piles might be the right thing from concrete saving, but actually it's the wrong thing when you look at the fact that we just blighted the site with 300 piles as opposed to 100 piles, for example, if you did want to go down the meter,
if you like. Because you got less flexibility in the layout and for future
uses. Yeah, I mean, the pinnacle, we had a undulating piles that were only 30 years old, you know. Prior to that, we had Victorian buildings with grillage foundations, etc., you know. Mm. So, you know, this is why I get passionate about reuse as well. Yeah. You know, it's done quite a few foundation reuse there. So the first thing I do is, I don't want any piles, and can I give my structural engineers a really hard time to think about movement? Differential movement, settlements, etc. Yeah, and squeeze them to the pip until they say, "Oh, Dinesh, I need piles." Then I put piles in, if you like.
Yeah.
So if I can put a raft in, fine. Then I say to myself, "Well, okay, if I have a pile areas, if you like, I don't have to design the piles with high factors of safety. All I'm doing is trying to control movement, so settlement reduces. So I can push those piles with very low factors, okay? Which means that the piles are then becoming economical. Not only are they economical, they don't need to go very deep either, because you can design them with low factors of safety just to control movement. Right. In this number 6 to 8 Bishop is slightly different because there is a huge load coming down. But, you know, generally speaking, I'm saying that's how I approach a problem, the control movement. I have to design for ULS, but the serviceability is more important and dear to me, as the serviceability aspect is about controlling the movement and settlement of the foundation. There, you can flip it the other way. Sometimes it's not compression that's governing, it's actually the heave. You've got a lightweight structure, you know, but you dug a big hole in the ground.
Yeah.
And as a consequence of digging a big hole in the ground, it's the ground heave that's dictating things. Okay, you've got a suspended floor slab, but then that requires piles. But if you could do a raft and maybe pin things down with small piles, if you like, and have few of them, you're controlling settlements in areas that need to.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were talking previously about settlements at working over, when half time's working over for piles. If you had a foundation, it won't be sort of 5-10 mil that's allowed in terms of settlement. It'll be 20-30 mil. So clearly the structures can take a lot more movement. Yeah. And certainly if you had a lighter weight superstructure, and we're seeing more timber structures actually be.
That's right.
Multi-story yeah. timber structures going up now.
Yeah.
They should be inherently more capable of dealing with greater settlement. So
I mean, you're absolutely right, and I think that actually, you know, one of the things that actually is a very weak, we're very weak as an industry, is that we don't share information. Can you imagine, you know, if I shared with Central Pine and all their, my database, and you shared all your database with me, and that happened on a FPS and a consultancy basis, if you like, you know, would I be doing a site investigation next door to where you've just done your site investigation?
Yeah, it seems incredibly inefficient, doesn't it?
Yeah.
By the way, I do like the idea of a swapping, because I think I'm getting a better deal there. But, at the last FPS meeting, I didn't mention your concept of collecting all this data, maybe being hosted by the Federation of Planning Specialists. You know, so you could go onto a map and you could find, like, this site, the piles were this load and they were this diameter and this depth. And we've talked for years about the reuse of foundations, and the Rufus project was a really important piece of work. But I think there's still a great risk of foundation records being lost for future generations. And if there was a single point where all of the records are held, in a similar way to the BGS boreholes and their map and record collection, then can only be a positive thing, really. But I think it's something that's going to have to be maybe driven by government to an extent.
Yeah. Well, I've got an acronym, which is, I think I'm going to call it the British Archive Construction Database, okay? Backed, if you like.
Okay.
Right.
And I was worried what that was going to spell for a moment.
We could actually emulate what the BGS are doing, you know, with the borehole database, you know. Some of it might be confidential, some of it is actually open source, if you like, you know. We would be in a better position for our future society. You know, whenever I'm continuously doing retrofits and reuse jobs, okay. And there are certain companies where you can get access to the information. The Powell Frischmans have a great record. Alan Baxter have a great record. You know, we can go back 60 years, back in 1965, on any projects, and you see hard copies and drawings, etc. Often it's not just the drawings; it's actually about the stuff that went with it, if you like, the calculations, etc. This is valuable. But what I'm seeing is that we can talk about sustainability until we're blue in the face. If we don't have records, we still end up doing things which is counterintuitive. Why do we need to put more piles in, you know, to support something that's new? Contractors tend to get rid of records after about 12 years. Okay. I've just been looking at a building which is only barely 20 years old and looking at what we can do with that. I've seen a drawing that showed loads of piles, okay? But I've got no idea whether it was built like that. I've got no idea whether it's got any lengths in it, because it hasn't, okay? Mm-hmm. I don't know how it's been designed. I can use best practice assumption to know what the approximate length is. But now I'll be putting lots of money into some sort of site investigation to prove whether these things even exist in terms of its density, in terms of its length, if you like. I'm putting lots of information into that's unnecessary. The cost of doing site investigation compared with conventional SI work for foundation reuse can be twice as much or three times as much, because you're opening holes through concrete slabs to do parallel seismic stuff, etc. Okay, yeah, it's expensive, and it's because the records have been lost. If you know, not intentionally. Sometimes it's about contractors going, being bought out or bust, if you like, and records are lost. And we need to be smart as an industry, trying to encourage the FPS or our institutions, the civils or structures, where your stuff can be given to them, is in the cloud. They can decide, with your permission or not, whether to give it to anybody else and share it. Okay. But after 12 years, anybody can share.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's got to be the right way to go forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. Who makes that decision? I mean, maybe this is something that we need to lobby Build UK or the ICE to then take forward to the government.
Yeah. And our clients, if I went to a client and said, look, you know, I know it's got confidential at the moment, but wouldn't it be a great interest if this .org, you know,
yeah,
website holds the data, and when you sell your building and you've lost the records and I'm not around or something, you know, the record exists and you can give to your tenants this gold mine of information, which is all the calculation. Not only that, there's calculations there. You know, building control are throwing records away as well. And so, you know, tier one contractors have thrown huge amounts of information away after 12 years, and all they've left with me is maybe a GR information that helps them do the design next to their site if it comes in the future.
You know what, Ground Forum meeting, I'll put it at the top of the agenda and we'll see how we can take this forward.
Thank you, Steve.
A lot of people will recognise your name and your face from the BBC One programme about Claridge's, it's called Mega Build. For anyone that hasn't watched it, try and find it. It was on iPlayer. I don't think it is currently, but it seems to get back on there occasionally, and there's whether it be Netflix, I'm sure it'll be somewhere in the future, but it's an incredible show and a really interesting project. Dinesh, can you just explain some of the complexity around that scheme and what it was like to be a TV star?
Yeah, well, being a TV star, well, that's actually debatable, because I think, you know, the BBC camera crew by default were following us around for almost 5 years, and my fall to fame was maybe a 2-minute. How do you follow a crew that's been interviewing you for 5 years, and then it turns out to be just a 5 minutes of Dinesh Patel or Michelle or Jim Mackey or whoever it is, Alice Berry and Andy Pye and Sarah Glover, all over it in all this, you know. But do you want me to start from how we got the project? And then,
yeah,
you know,
that'd be great.
Yeah, it was really... Jim Mackey and myself, you know.
So Jim Mackey is
From McGee.
From McGee, yeah. He's like the, was he project manager his title?
He looks a bit like Einstein with hair all over the place and a beard.
He's a great character.
All white, great character, you know. And I think he's got the brain of Einstein anyway, but from a building perspective. My daughter's got Michelle Mackey, and she's wonderful as well.
Yeah,
very switched on. And I love them to bits, you know, because their heart is in buildability and doing the best, the very best of what they can do. And being innovative, you know, which I love doing from a design perspective, but they do it from a building perspective, you know. And Jim is full of ideas about doing things which box the industry trends, if you like, okay? If it wasn't for construction, he'd probably be a natural inventor. He'd probably be making millions, being the owner of Dyson or something similar to that. If you like, you know, very, very inventive person. I knew him and have known him as a great friend for at least 25 years.
Yeah.
We worked on Unilever, many, many projects.
Always with McGee, or is
different? He's always been with McGee. He's a bit like me, a bit of a lifer, you know.
Yeah.
Whether it was by intent or by default, I don't know. So when you have a relationship, the whole of the industry is about relationship game. Yeah? There are people that you trust like a family.
Yeah.
And then there are people that you collaborate and work as a team in that trusting environment. You do better than your best. And both Jim and I have worked with that kind of philosophy on every project that we have been in contact with, you know, through the years. So, you know, the Claridge project was when he decided that he was going to retire. He didn't even know. He'd done some work beforehand, and he decided to retire. before he retired, we met up and he said, Dinesh, there's one major project I'm going to tell you about. That's the only one project that I would come out of retirement with. He did tell me what that project was, okay? And out of the blue, a month later, he rings me up and said, Dinesh, I'm coming out of retirement. And I said, it's only 1 month. Oh, yeah, but there's a major client. And he said, it's Claridge's project. You're going to fall over your chair and explain the project. And he said, I haven't done any design work. It's just a concept of how I might build it.
Okay.
To give this client the dream of doing a five-level basement underneath a working hotel without closing the hotel. Originally, and you started off being two levels of basement. No, three levels of basement. And then the client said, oh, if you could do three levels, can you do five levels? Yes, sure, you know. But anyway, the story was that he came out of retirement, explained the job to me, and he said, who's your best structural engineer? And I said, best structural engineer I know is Andy Pye. Very inventive person, goes back to, like me, to basics, if you like. He goes back to basics and structures. I go back to basics and geotechnics, and then we can do something right, quite complicated. So Jim trusted me to get the right team. We didn't tender for the project, just said, Dinesh, you won't believe this. The client, I've just sold him the concept. I haven't got a design. I'm just like Reva stage zero, you know, yeah. Or one. Sold him the concept, and he's just given me a job. And can you find a structural engineer? I said, fine, I'll find a structural engineer. And then I said, how do I go and tell Andy Pye that, you know, I'd like him to work on the project? So I took him out for a pint, not telling him anything about the project. And after a couple of pints, I was brave enough to broach the subject. But actually, I think I've landed myself in this crazy project, you know, building a five-well basement without hurting anybody or the guests that are living in the hotel. And he did fall off his chair, but he liked the fact that it was crazy, you know, which is what Arabs love doing, crazy projects, if you like, you know. And he thought it was great, you know, that you could do something that actually no one else has done. So right, without him, I wouldn't have been able to take on this geotechnical and structural knowledge of design and build, you know, to Jim Mackey. I would have turned him down. Fortunately, when you're a director in Arabs, you're empowered to do whatever you like, okay? Without actually lots of people sort of dropping on you and saying, don't do this, don't do that, etc. Okay? So I didn't have the board come back to me and say, oh, Dinesh, what the hell are you doing with this kind of project, you know? Aren't you attracting too much risk to Arabs, etc., you know? I didn't fortunately have that at the time that we took on the project with the right conditions, etc. And then as we started going on the project, we realized what the challenges were. You know, the challenges were, became even more difficult. It wasn't just about doing a five-level basement, 66,000 square feet of development, you know, below the hotel. But the client said, well, I'm only going to give you two rooms. Initially started with one room, seven by 7 meter square room, you know, and said, right, okay, that's your construction site. And we thought, what? But every other room was used as back office staff and kitchens and the services, the whole Victorian building, the Art Deco building.
So literally every shovel full of muck has got to come out of this 7 by 7 room.
Fortunately, the building was sitting on a raft. It was the very early days of how you would design a raft. It wasn't the sort of raft that you would design today with lots of more reinforcement. It was effectively a brittle raft, if you like. Okay. It lacked reinforcement, you know.
So you've got to create almost another raft under that before then put in some columns to underpin that structure so you can then dig out for the, sure, the new basement.
Yeah. And that's where the difficulty was, that actually once we had the concept, which is create a shaft, let's say two and a half meter by 2.5 meter opening first in the raft, doing about 1.1 meters thick. This is a 100-year-old raft. and then the tunnel underneath horizontally has added 1.8 meter diameter tunnels, tunnel into every column location, and then drop a vertical shaft 30 meters down, 30 meters down, where the bottom, say 5 to 7 meters, was the foundation, the handed caisson, and the top 20 meters was a temporary lining, steel lining.
So this comes back to the project that we were talking about at the start of the conversation, doesn't it?
Yes.
So you were borrowing those techniques. I don't know if Jim had done any of that before, but...
I'm sure he had. Yeah. Jim hadn't been involved on the Embankment Place project, though, I said.
Yeah.
But had done, he and I had done something in Unity in a similar way. You know? So his idea, his concept was, we just simply go and do lots of horizontal adits, 400 meters of adits, all lined with a steel frame at every half meter intervals, get to the column position that is supporting the structure, then drop in a vertical shaft below the raft where the actual existing column is, down 30 meters, build the 7 meters or 5 meters of caisson foundation with a bell, and then come up in this 1.8 meter diameter caisson and build the column inside that 1.8 meter diameter caisson that you dropped in initially, and bring the column all the way up to the top of the underside of the existing raft, then put some jacks in there so that actually we can compensate the building movement during construction activity. So that was the concept. The challenges were the fact that actually, how do you control the movement of the building to acceptable limits through all this construction process, in some very challenging ground conditions as well, which I'll explain in a minute, without damaging or close the ornate facade that's in the building, or evacuating the guests, if you like, who are living above a live construction site. Remember, we found out later that possibly if we close the hotel, the client may have lost something like £200 million over a 3-year period. Okay. And we built him a basement for about £40 million, excluding fit out, if you know.
Yeah.
So you can imagine that actually, and the hotel would have died without the facilities that were required.
Yeah, customers would have found new places to go for their relationship. Yeah,
because it never had a swimming pool, it never had a gym, it didn't have any boutique shopping, It was living on the fact that actually you got treated like royalty, as if you were in the Victorian era, and that's why it was commanding this thing. But actually, the client was very far reaching in his future thoughts, about what he wanted to do with Clarity's. And you'd have to take hats off to him that he had the brave enough, to do it, if you like. So, we had the lessons I learned about the slime.
Yeah.
We encountered at Claridge's. The raft was sitting on this very soft material. That was the biggest. We thought the raft originally would be just sitting on gravel of a London clay.
Yeah.
But we just pumped like mad, temporarily.
Yeah.
Okay? We weren't expecting a lot of gravel. But we had the River Tyburn, which ran down Brooks Mews, which is at the back of at the back of Claridge, and it left its soft sediments all the way through into our development, if you like.
Yeah.
So you had this very soft, silty, alluvial sandy clay, if you like, a clay fraction of less than 20%, and the rest of it was a fine sand, coarse silt.
So the slabs sat on that.
Yeah.
How did you reinforce the slab? Because the columns that you're creating, they're quite widely spaced.
They were about 4.5 meters. The biggest was 7.5 meters. So we didn't reinforce the existing route. One of the big challenges was, the three challenges. One was structural, two of them geotechnical. The structural challenge is how do I deal with the movements created by the construction activities of digging tunnels and shafts, and that results in the bending of the shaft before I even actually do any jacking operation to compensate the building. How do I, if I dewater, ground at the same time, if I dig tunnels, I'm creating voids underneath the raft, existing raft. That's going to cause movements, okay? How do I, do it in the most productive way? So dewatering I can't control. I can make a guess as to what the movements would be, and I have to live with those movements. Headings I built, or adits I built, I can control because I can actually jack the steel freight so that the jacking can be in the top tree, the side trees, and the bottom sill of the frame, the picture frame, which is in steel, can then, drop the load from the top of the column down in for a frame into the base, if you like, temporarily, before I build the foundations and the columns and then install the jacks, if you like. Okay. But nevertheless, open up voids, causing movements of some sort, even if I did use some bottle jacks to jack each frame every half a meter. But the key thing was that the raft only had something like reinforcement of 400 to 450 mil centers compared with something which is half that. So it behaved in a brittle way. And our structural engineers were worried about the fact that actually the ground movements would cause a brittle failure of the raft. No one likes anything to fail in a brittle way. Ductility is good, So just like straight shafted piles, when you reach 1% of pile diameter, it fails in a brittle way. It sustains a load, but and it can reduce a little bit, if you like, But compared with an undering pile, it never fails in a brittle way because the load keeps coming up until you get the full end back, if you like, The raft, because it is concrete with very little steel, the steel is there to avoid a brittle failure. But actually, because we lacked steel, we found ourselves in a very difficult position because there are no codes that define how that 100-year-old raft works. So we embarked on a study, which was to try a numerical study that tried to explicitly model the reinforcement in the raft. So, and then we carried out a load test, if you like, in the numerical model with explicit modeling of the steel so that we could take the column up to an ultimate load and see at what points the steel yielded. And then if they started yielding, then it would be a progressive failure of all the bars that we put into that reinforcement at a point where you get an ultimate failure of the raft. That gave you some insights as to how much movement that raft could tolerate.
Right.
Okay.
So then you monitor it.
Exactly. Okay. Now, when you do plaxis, when you do any finite element model, you can't explicitly model reinforcement. So there's no point me doing a soil structure interaction model when I can't explicitly model a 100-year-old reinforced slab, because all I can say is it's got short-term stiffness and a crack stiffness, if you like. But what's happening in between is more important than the bounding the problem. Okay. So we went off and actually did a soil structure interaction model, realizing that actually the slab is not modeled properly, but modeling every sequence of operation that Jim would be putting in place to work out what movements we'd be getting underneath the existing raft. okay? A, to understand what damage might do to the facade and to the interior, highly decorated finishes. But most importantly, did we have a job? Because if we had a brittle failure from this exercise, then we wouldn't have a job. The movements we got were then put into this model that I said, which actually explicitly modeled the reinforcement. And we were able to determine that the risk of a brittle failure was controllable. So in other words, we knew that if we had something more than about 30 millimeters differential movement, okay, not just total movement, then we were in trouble. The first ping of a reinforcement yielding would happen at that point. And then we got some more breathing space, but that set our trigger limits, if you like, okay? Yeah, against what we were monitoring. If we ever reached those trigger limits, once we had the jacks in place, we were able to control it. So that then sorted out the structural bit, if you like,
yeah.
Okay? Yeah. Then we had the slime or the tuff paste, which is the silt that from the Tyburn that was in this floodplain on which the raft was sitting. Now you might think, well, why did the Victorian put a raft on something quite soft? Because no other solution worked. The Victorian didn't have hiding things.
No.
Yeah, they had grillage foundation. They either did pads. Pads would have failed, but something that you can lay in a blanket, then sitting on this material is a constrained movement. The soil is constrained. The soft material is constrained. It can't push out on the sides, if you like.
Yeah, right? And doing it over such a wide span, as it is.
Yeah, so it's like just a 1D type consolidation. Yeah. Okay. So we had this very soft material that actually we were dealing with, and we tried to and scratch our head and say, well, actually, the miners can't work with this. This thing is flowing. You know, I remember Sarah Glover sitting in this hole that we created through that single room, opened up. We took a block of a concrete down, and she was standing over it, and she was sinking, you know, and then she had to be quickly taken out. It was that soft, if you like, you know, just the weight of it, and she's quite lightweight, by the way, you know, not like me. And we knew we had a problem here. We couldn't do any of those tunnel add-ins that I mentioned, you know, encountering this material. I had some experience of PFA lagoons, you know, and we thought that actually we can use vacuum dewatering. It's too fine a material to do pumping, well pointing, etc. Okay? We couldn't ground freeze it. We couldn't get into every room and do that because it was out of bounds. You know, we only had one room. We couldn't do jet grouting for the same reason. Okay, and we thought that we can suck the water out from the very fine material. Having sucked the water out, you cause surface tension. So the particles want to close in due to surface tension, or let's call it surface moisture tension, if you like, okay? So as you suck out the water, the material inherently, through surface tension, gets stronger. You only need a 4% change in moisture content to change the properties of this material from something that has a Cu of 20 to a Cu of 50, which is then mineable. Only 4%. Okay? So we use that solution to try and suck the water out from other places, almost like a vacuum, if you like, you know. Which were out of bounds, if you like. We managed to get a second room to do our pumping trials. And Toby Roberts at WJ Engineering did a fantastic job. You know how Toby is, you know. He's just a phenomenal person. And we found a way of solving that problem. Then I turned the concept into a real design. For the first 6 months, we didn't have a design. And yet the client just thought, we're on our way, everything's hunky-dory, it'll be fine, you know. And then the final challenge was actually we were putting piles in right underneath, right at the bottom of the London clay. And is it sand here? Are we likely to hit a band of sand that is under water pressure just at the interface between the bottom of the London clay and the Lambeth beds? And all the time, we knew that Bond Street had a huge problem with water at that interface, which is only 200 meters away or so, you know, with the Crossrail bots. But fortunately, we did enough investigate both beforehand to know that that was not happening. The monitoring really was really super critical. So Andrew Ridley from Geo Observations, you know, did liquid leveling sensors that he fitted to all the columns. Fantastic work that he did. We were able to monitor live, you know, all the movements that were happening. We were measuring for the very first time the weight of the structure on every single column. Okay, so we can use all the dead loads and the live loads, and believe me when I say we over-designed for live load. And that's another factor of safety that we should be, you know, really content thinking about, you know. And remember the other job that I said where I put a hand case on Embankment Place? The live load there was hardly anything on the same load. So this job and that job are compatible, but in different ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, our structural engineers don't design conservatively with live loads, which is another factor on all factors. So we could save on lots of sustainability potentials if we were able to be designing smarter structurally and geotechnically. And we monitored the settlements that were caused during the initial activities, and they were somewhere around about the total was about 40 millimeters. But differentials are always less than the breaking point of the slab, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we were expecting heave to occur as well. So, you know, when you excavate, you know, 5 levels of basement, the whole foundations are moving upwards due to heave. And so we were compensating the jacks for settlements and compensating jack for heave by two flat jacks. So one was to address settlements because the travel was only about 28 millimeters, and the other one was actually for a heave, if you like, you know, so we can just let one down in terms of pressure.
But how much decoration or even structural work did you have to do on the superstructure after the basement had been completed?
Nothing. We had only one area where we had some hairline cracks, and that was the interface between the old Victorian structure, which is sitting on a mass concrete raft, compared with the lightly reinforced brittle raft that we were dealing with the Alteco building, which is abutted against it. We did have some slight cracks on a building that was adjoining the Art Deco building that we were doing the basement under. But that was a historical building that had already, we think, had suffered damage when the 100-year-old raft was being cast, if you like, and then they decorated out and the cracks had gone away, and we just reopened the cracks up, if you like, in the facade, in the stunt facade that we had there.
There's some incredible engineering right there. I mean, I could really talk to you all day, and there's stuff I had on the list to discuss, and maybe that'll be a part three episode, but for today, thank you so much for spending so much of your valuable time with me discussing your career and some incredible projects. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. I've gone on a bit, and maybe some of the story has not been continuous, and I've jumped around a little bit. I hope I haven't bored your audience, but it's been a very relaxing conversation with you, and there's an art to that, and you've done very well.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. I'm sure our listeners have thoroughly enjoyed it.